this around. Everybody's sitting over here. Well, we'll start the meeting a little late. Thank you for coming. We had a very, I think, worthwhile meeting this afternoon, and we'll be carrying on again tomorrow morning at the Senior Citizens Center at 10 o'clock in the morning, and then we'll come back here in the afternoon in case there are any others who wish to participate.
I'm Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission, and I'm looking into the land claim settlement, ANCSA. But I'm here because the two international Native peoples organizations asked me to come. The Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which represents Eskimo people from Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, and the World Council of Indigenous People, which represents Indian people in North and South America. They asked me to come and look at meetings like this throughout Alaska, and to find out how you people feel about the land claim settlement, 1991, subsistence, sovereignty, all of these questions, and to write a report that I hope will be helpful to you people. To write a report that I hope will be helpful to you people here in Alaska, and to Native people and their governments in other countries around the world, because we are trying to see what has happened here in Alaska about land claims and what can be done about the what are seen to be flaws, defects, deficiencies in the land claim settlement here in Alaska. I think you know Mary Kenswick, who is traveling with me, and Jim Sykes, who is running the sound equipment. We're taking everything down that is said so that there will be a permanent record of what Alaska Natives have to say about ANCSA, and there will be a transcript made, and it will be sent to the local corporation and the local IRA and the other Native organizations in Nome and in the region. And I will be writing a report that will be made public next summer, and in it BC, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous Peoples will be able to go to the United Nations with that report if they wish. But I hope, in addition, it will be a report that is constructive and helpful and that Alaska Natives can use in deciding for themselves what changes they think should be made in the land claim settlement. Well, we had a very good meeting this afternoon. About 25 people spoke, and a great many more attended, and I look forward to what you people have to say this evening. When you speak, if you would like to come up here and sit right here by this microphone, that would be very helpful to us because it means everything you say can be recorded. If you'd rather go to that microphone over there in the middle of the room, that's fine too, but whatever suits you. Well, I think that I've said enough.
I'm Gibu Jamo. I'm from Koyak. In 1982 and 1983, I was involved in subsistence research of the Seward Peninsula, Eskimos living in lifestyle. My research was done basically of one village of some 450 inhabitants. This village is considered one of the most traditional villages on the Seward Peninsula. I interviewed some 77 individuals in this research.
Can you give me the name of the village?
Shishmaref. Where, when, how, why they hunt. Most of these individuals were the elders. These people are probably last generation with some expert knowledge of their land. They have names for every stream, river, hill, etc. They have knowledge of when and where the birds eat in spring and fall, where the walrus comes to eat, when the seals are nearby, where to pick the berries. These people can tell you how they hunt, and they eat enough, they hunt enough, so that they can have some more to hunt for the next time. If these people can utilize and control their hunting, fishing, and trapping, then I don't understand why they can't control their own land rights. With either state or federal government controlling land, then they are controlling the Eskimos hunting. When they control all this, they are telling us, you only can eat moose when we say so. What if the moose season is not timely enough? Maybe we need a longer season. Sometimes moose don't come too close to the village, or when they do come around, it's the wrong sex. And councils of villages before making decisions and regulations, then things would work out a lot better for both parties. So if these state or federal governments regulate, then they should be hiring the local people instead of bringing in their own from outside. I think that all people know that the man who knows his job is the best man for the job. The natives know their land better than any USGS BLM man. The knowledge they have now may be limited, and where they get this knowledge is from. I believe that hiring local natives for local jobs is number one priority in any village or town. Thank you.
How many people did you interview all together?
77 in Shishmaref.
Did you interview people at other places as well?
Yes.
Me that you be able to decide for themselves when to hunt and what to hunt and how best to ensure that they don't overhunt or overkill, to make sure that the resource is preserved and not diminished. Tell me what you think or what the people you interviewed thought about how that is to be done. In other words, if they think they're the people to do it, would they want the fish and game people and the federal people just to give up their hunting and their supervision of hunting and fishing activities? Or, in other words, how would they go about it?
To most of the elders I talked to, they mostly chose state instead of the federal government governing regulations of fish and game. And what they're trying to say is maybe if they talk to them first sometimes in some things, or then, you know, they wouldn't have to fight so hard for it.
Mm-hmm. I take it that Shishmaref, being a traditional village, most of the people live by subsistence.
Yes, the majority of the village, yeah.
And they are engaged in hunting, certainly on corporation land, state land, and federal land, are they?
Yes, Barren Land Bridge.
Pardon me?
It's a National Preserve, Barren mm-hmm. Land Bridge.
Yeah, and subject to federal regulation, they have the right to go in there and take and hunt.
Yes, yes.
Well, what conclusions did you reach about all this? You were doing the research, you were interviewing them. What did you decide for yourself at the end of it all about this?
Well, I learned a lot more than I decided anything on what the people felt. I'm just all with the people.
But before you went and did this, and compared to at the end of it all, what was the biggest impression you had about what ought to be done?
I just, I think the people ought to listen to the villagers a lot more, the federal and state,
mm-hmm.
instead of sometimes overlooking something. They decide themselves in D.C. instead of maybe getting something from the people.
Instead of just announcing that
yeah.
as of a certain date you can't hunt moose and so on.
Yes. I'm just using this as a per se. It's nothing yeah. that...
Could you leave us a copy of your
yeah.
submission?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Peter Buck again, and I'd like to talk about the, in 1936, the government granted the IOA governments of all of Alaska, and in that act, they claimed that the IRAs were a sovereign government. That means they can, as a sovereignty, they can control their own lands, control their own political policies, can control their own destiny as self-determination. And the IRAs in Alaska formed the United Tribes of Alaska. And in forming United Tribes, they formed their thing about a policy to have the United Tribes of Alaska.
But it means that you have access to another forum to talk about these questions. But it seems to me the most important place to talk about sovereignty for Alaska Native governments is in Alaska and in Congress. The question of Native sovereignty is not something that has come up only in Alaska. It's come up in many countries in recent years. Sometimes it's called sovereignty, sometimes self-determination, sometimes self-rule, sometimes home rule. The Eskimos in Greenland have obtained home rule. They have their own government that runs Greenland now. In northern Canada, the government of Canada has agreed to divide the Northwest Territories so that there will be an Eskimo territory, that is where the Eskimos will be the vast majority of the population and will in essence run the government. In Maine, the Congress made a settlement with the Indian people of Maine, the state of Maine, in 1980, and they agreed that the IRA governments in Maine would be recognized as by the federal government, and they would also be recognized by the state government. I mention these things just to show that there's an awful lot happening in an awful lot of places about sovereignty, and it may be that Alaska Natives and others should be looking at what's happening at these other places.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, I'm Richard Atek. Thank you for this opportunity to say something about the Claims Act. I've worked from November of 72 for ANSCA corporations or ANSCA-related corporations, and I think I've thought about the question quite a bit as to what does ANSCA mean and what's it all about. And it's kind of a tough question. I would really be interested in your report, and particularly with a view as to what the younger people are saying. I was here this afternoon, and it seemed like I didn't hear too much from what they said, and I'm particularly curious as to what they would say, since they will be the ones that inherit whatever we do, whatever mistakes we make, or whatever we win. I don't think it's so much win or lose. I've thought about the Claims Act, and the only way it sort of makes sense to me is to try to think about what things would be like if it did not take place. I think a lot of people have asked about what it has given, and I think that maybe it hasn't, it has given something, it has not taken away anything that I can see. I think one of the side benefits of ANSCA that I really have appreciated is that it has provided a mechanism and a means of communication within the state. I think that whatever the case may be, the natives, particularly in this region, and I think for each region, have talked to each other and have learned of each other's common concerns. And I think that other than through the corporations, those concerns have been brought up with the state and federal agencies. And I think there have been very many changes for the good as a result of people being heard. And I think it's includes sessions like these where people have a chance to say whatever's on their mind. I might add that the vehicles of the corporations, the regional corporations and the village corporations, were provided money, and I don't know that that was the best use of it, but I do know that money provides a means to for people to get their thoughts together for whatever purpose they may have. So that's one area, and maybe the most important one, that communication has been made possible. And I think we're just starting to hear from the older people, from people my age, and I hope that you hear from the younger generation, the next generation. Something that I was kind of struck by in reviewing the 1985 study very briefly, it recalled to my mind that at the turn of the century, the population of the state was about equal, about 100,000 natives and 100,000 non-natives. And at the present time, the natives are a minority by about 6-1 or 7-1, depends on who you count. But I think that the ANSCA, through the vehicle of the corporation, has allowed those concerns to be heard. And I would like to recall what Job said earlier this afternoon, that we are not yet conquered. And I kind of like that, that before we were conquered, that the ANSCA, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, took place so that there was a means to be heard. There's one area I think that I see the most conflict in, and of course that involves either the land or the law, whichever one you want to look at. And when I wonder what is this ANSCA Corporation all about, I recall what one of our leaders said, which was probably the best explanation for me at the time, and I think still is now. And that was Martin Olson. And when somebody, he stated in somewhat along these lines that wasn't ANSCA, isn't this all about the idea that there were some Indians in the interior or natives elsewhere that had some land that they used? And isn't this about the idea that miners were coming in and taking that land? And that's when it started to make sense to me that before ANSCA, the natives did not have a written law. They had their own law, which nobody else respected because they didn't know about it, as far as I can tell. And without ANSCA, I'm afraid that the newcomers to the state would have continued to take land through the existing land laws, primarily the mining claim laws and laws similar to them. So this is the one thing that I see good about it. It has provided a means for the natives to protect their own land rights. But it also comes with some difficulties. Like I said, I've worked for the Native corporations quite a while. And often stockholders say, we want such and such regarding this land. And it's very difficult to tell them, but the law does not provide for that. And that doesn't seem to matter. And that's one of the conflicts that existed and still exists, I think. What I'm recognizing when I hear the elders speak is that when they have a problem with the land, they want certain things. And as administrators, we have a difficult time trying to get that because we're working with a law, some kind of land law that we did not write. And when the elders misunderstand something, I don't put very much blame on them because they were not the ones that wrote the laws that we're working with. And I think this is something that both the state government and the federal government could think about a little bit more. We often deal with existing laws that somebody else wrote. And if we're a people and we did not write the law, we have a hard time explaining it, making sense of it, and making it fit a country and a people that did not need that law before. I think that an overview of something like this would make sense. I think that sometimes what happens is that if a state or a federal government official wants to be helpful, he can find ways to do so. On the other hand, if he is for some reason against natives or something that we're for, that he can take the law. And it's, they tend to be pretty complicated laws. And he can find those loopholes and make things pretty difficult. I think the corporations as a vehicle have been relatively successful. I think that there's something about them, though, that makes it difficult. And I think that's the idea that they have become a vehicle asked to do everything and to do quite a bit more than they were intended. And I look forward to the day in some villages that the city government and the IRA government and the Native Corporation can work pretty closely together. And I think that's part of what it's about. Something that's pretty frustrating for me in my work is I hear people talking about the Claims Act with regard to what they did or did not get out of it. It becomes kind of personal and kind of measured upon what each individual gets out of it. I think, though, when I remind you about what I was talking about, communications and some kind of a political force, I think that as a whole, the people in the state have a lot more than they would have if people just got money. Some people would get money and then it would be gone. And I know that this other way is a lot harder to understand, why the money seems to go to the native leaders, the ones with the jobs. And that's part of the price, I think. And on my own part, I always remember that prior to taking these jobs, I was a petroleum geologist and very happy where I was. And I wonder all these years, why did I come up here? And I don't know if that was some sense of feeling like I had some job to do or some sense of pride. I don't know. I think that one of the keys that we can come back to that I see a problem with is that of the village corporation. That surface ownership of the land, I think, means a lot. And it's at risk right now. We heard about the barracudas this afternoon. And I think even though all of the corporations might not be jeopardized, I think some of them would be. And I think other than that, just when the money runs out, there would be no vehicle left to be some kind of a quasi-government. I don't know. I don't certainly have the answers. But I do recognize that when people do not have land, they do not have very much. They do not have very much of that identity. And they become just a resident in their own land, a renter of their own land. And you mentioned that some of the things that might or might not be useful to the natives in Canada, for instance. I would just have to compare with where the natives are in Alaska and how they are treated. On a whole, I think pretty fairly. I think in Canada, the natives, at least when I've been over there, and particularly in the more southern parts, I don't see that they have as much as the natives do here. In the long run, I would say that the key is for the village corporations to somehow keep their lands, and I think the IRAs could be instrumental in that. When somebody had asked me about that, however, I think it applies to each situation on a case-by-case basis, depending on how the standing of the IRA is in 1991 in that particular village. And in some cases, the village corporation might be a little bit stronger. I think I don't think that there is one specific entity that's going to answer everything, but I think that each village can take some time and see what fits best for its own specific situation or circumstance. I think I said a lot more than I was going to. I would be interested to see if you take written comments that can be submitted later on.
Yes, I would like to receive those, Mr. Adak, and maybe I could say for the benefit of everyone that we have an office in Anchorage, and please feel free to write to us, after this meeting is over, at any time with anything you want to add to what you said. I sure would appreciate receiving anything that you send to us in writing. And you can get our address from Mary Kenswick. She has cards that she'll give you. And Mary Miller also knows our address. And you can get it from Kowarik. Could I just ask you a couple of questions? You said something very interesting, I think, that the key lies in the villages and their... in some way or other, retaining their lands. And you also said you've been involved in the corporations now for 10 or 12 years. What do you, what about this question of the divided ownership, surface and subsurface? Have you thought about that? And everywhere I go, people in the villages say, we should have the subsurface as well as the surface. And one or two said that here today. What do you make of that?
I think I'm biased because I have worked for the regional corporation too, and I also have worked for the village corporations. One of the things that I have recognized in rural Alaska is that we don't have very many people living out here. We don't have that many people in terms of having a human resource. I think that there's quite a bit of pressure put on the leaders that exists within each region to draw up from their own shareholders people with certain educations and so on. I think overall the concept is good for that reason, that a pooled resources, human resources, is a good idea. That part of the idea I like. And of course, in this region, the corporation itself made some expenditures pretty fast, which has been the cause of some strife. That's the regional corporation. So I kind of have mixed feelings about it. I also feel like one of the benefits of the Claims Act itself is that it has allowed people to make their own mistakes. And in this situation, it's too bad that the mistakes were made. But on the other hand, I think that there's a chance that those things can still be rectified, even though in a long time. I think what I'm trying to say overall is that I try to look at the bigger picture when I made allusions to the younger generation. I think this is something that it's about. And one thing that I am really concerned about that I wanted to mention too is that the stock distribution, where the stock goes and kind of fans out and gets divided more and more, while I'm not against that idea, I am against the idea that the stock is going to be split up and up, and it's going to cost a lot of money to keep track of all those little shares. And I think if there's something that can be done to avoid that costly stock registry process, I think that would be good. I have an idea of seeing what has happened to Indian allotments in the lower 48. I think those are areas that people can work on with some kind of innovation that would make some kind of sense.
You're thinking of the division of allotments into little pieces in the lower 48.
Yes, the native allotments in the lower 48 were passed along through inheritance too, and while I was not against being passed along, I was concerned about how much it cost after several generations to keep track of all those little shares. Some of those numbers are pretty astounding as to how far and how small they get split up into.
Yeah. If you were back in 1971 and you had to decide whether to do some of these things the way they were done, you've indicated you would go along still with the divided ownership of surface and subsurface, but would you, I gather that you wouldn't go along with the idea of a shareholding corporation, or would you? Did I misunderstand you? What would be the best vehicle for holding the land, leaving aside the business activity and the profit-making activities, but what would be the best vehicle for owning the land? The for-profit corporation, non-profit corporation, IRA? Have you thought about that?
I have not really thought about that very much. I have not spent much time worrying about how things could have been, because that, at least in the situations I've been in, and my general outlook is to try to make something with what we have. I think that something that, in trying to answer your question from the spot, though, would be to have more checks and balances between entities like the village and regional, whether they be corporations or nonprofit or IRAs or whatever. I still felt like those entities need to exist, but maybe there could be better checks and balances. I think one of the things that I was really favoring early upon the passage of the Claims Act would be to spend more time for training and planning before making the investment moves. And I think something along those lines would make sense. Even though people would not like that additional restraint, I think that would be a good idea to think about if there were investment corporations.
Yeah. Well, coming forward to 1984, 85, 86, 87, if you had to advise one of the corporations about the best way to hold on to its land, and that entailed a transfer of the land to, that meant they had to choose between keeping it in the for-profit corporation, transferring it to a non-profit corporation, transferring it to an IRA, or transferring it to a new kind of trust. Any ideas about that?
Well, like I said, it would be interesting to see how the IRA stand, and I think before I put any land there myself, I would want to see exactly what they were and how much power they had. And I don't know if that question has been answered yet. I would try to wait until that one was answered. I hope that that they find some answers. I also am aware of the land bank, and I think that's a pretty good provision. It certainly wants more understanding. Other than that, I think that the issue will be talked about this year and has been talked about already and will be talked about in the future at AFN, called the 1991 question.
When I was at Galena, their village corporation had been negotiating with the federal government to put all of their land into the land bank, and negotiations this is in July, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, had stalled because the federal government hadn't really been able to devise its own position. But there are some that have actually been seeking to take advantage of the land bank. Do you know if any in this region are trying to do that?
I don't know of any. I think the way I understand the land bank is that you can put land in and take it back out. Now, that's the way I understand it. I have a question in my mind as to what would happen to that bank when the governments got done with it. I would be concerned if they would interpret it differently. But I don't think that has to happen. What I think has really happened so far is that not too many people in either the state or federal government have taken very much of an interest in working on the land bank because it doesn't give anything to them. And that's one of the problems with the land bank. It gives benefits to the native corporations, but doesn't give very much to the state and federal governments, although it's supposed to provide some kind of cooperative management. They have not talked about what that means.
Yeah, it may be that adjacent to national parks that the federal government can establish a uniform management regime. That may be an advantage to them. Anyway, well, thanks very much, sir.
Now, this is Peter Buck again, and I've just got so many questions to ask, and
Go ahead.
Anyway, we have a boy going through college, and he said he took a study in college, and he studied the Land Claims, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and he said while he was in college and taking that course, there was a lot of non-natives that were taking the course, and they said, gee, look what we got. I've got a lot of money. I got good education. And they're just finding all the loopholes they can find, and they're really surprised that they can, you know, find something like that. They're real, real glad that they found something like that. And I was wondering if any of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is doing anything about anybody coming in and finding all the loopholes. But what we're doing is just we're just going to get a bucket with a whole bunch of holes in it.
Well, a lot of people have learned from the experience of Alaska Natives. When the government of Canada made a settlement with the Eskimos of the Western Arctic just this summer, it came into force in August, and they got fee simple land just as you did, but they got actually more than you did on a per capita basis, but they also received exclusive rights over a much greater area to certain species, to polar bear and grizzly bear and muskox, and they also, over that much larger area, received a subsistence preference, which they, as native people, alone enjoy. And they had looked at your settlement, and they said to the government of Canada, "We want more emphasis on access to subsistence resources, fish and game. It isn't just a question of getting the land." They also obtained agreement that they set up a trust to hold the land, and every Inuit or Eskimo receives a certificate of trust, and the trust holds the land. And the certificate of trust is issued to every Eskimo as soon as he or she is born, and when they die, the certificate is canceled. so that it continues from generation to generation. Nobody can sell his certificate or transfer it or alienate it. So they solved the question of transferability of shares. They also, the government agreed that their land would never be taxable as long as it was undeveloped, that is, as long as it was used for subsistence. And they felt that these were criticisms of ANCSA that they wanted to avoid in making their settlement. The Indians in the Yukon Territory are still negotiating with the government of Canada, and they have already obtained agreement that where they take a certain percentage of the moose or the caribou, they will have that percentage in perpetuity, so that if the white population increases, they will continue to have the right to take the same percentage of the harvest as they take now. They made that agreement on some of the rivers too. I only mention that because they are some of the people who've been working on these problems since 1971, and it makes it worth your while, I think, to take a look at those other arrangements. In Australia, the natives are in northern Australia have worked out a settlement in the north where the elders hold the land in trust. That means it can't be sold, can't be transferred, and can't be taxed. And yet they're not under the supervision of the government, just as this recent settlement in Canada means that the trust that the Eskimos have for the land is not under the supervision of the federal government. That is, their land is held in trust by the federal government. That means it's safe from taxation and safe from any takeover, but they're under the jurisdiction, under the supervision to some extent of the government. So they're trying to get away from that and still preserve the immunity from taxation and the immunity from takeovers.
Is there any guarantee that this act that you're talking about in Canada and Australia, is there any guarantee that it will be put into ANCSA?
Well, no, none at all. I'm just saying that all of these things are happening right now in all of these places. You people started the ball rolling back in 1971. You know, yours was the first really important settlement in the modern era. Now everybody else is getting on the bandwagon, and they're, in a sense, benefiting from some of the things they've seen in ANCSA that haven't worked out as well as people had hoped. And I don't see why you can't, at this stage, in looking at your own situation, say, the world changes and moves on, and we should have the advantage of changes in thinking and improvements that are made. That's all. Yes, sir.
Hello. I'm from, I represent Gullivan Native Corporation, and what I think about ANCSA is that I think their morale is pretty damn low, you know. They're sitting on their chairs, you know. They're making to 50,000 to 70,000 a year, you know. They're not doing a hell of a lot for our corporations, you know. It's not. They're not. I don't think they represent us very good. I disagree with them, you know. I'm against that, you know. They don't represent us very good. Forty percent of them went to AFN on a convention down Anchorage, and 30% of them went down there half drunk, you know. And that's no good, you know. And we're talking about our native people here in Nome, all over the Seward Peninsula. That's no good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
My name is Daryl Trigg. Over the years, since the land claims, I've belonged to several different boards, including statewide boards and committees and governors, advisory committees and whatnot. But, you know, I looked at that statement that you guys sent out. In my opinion, you know, the ANCSA of 71 hasn't changed the socioeconomic status of Alaska Natives since its passage at all. You know, it raised high hopes. It was successful in dividing our people into many social and political camps. And it created, in most of the regions and villages, a very strong and sometimes bitter opponents, you know, both business and political. In a few cases, stockholders are still receiving minute amounts of dividends. And in the case of our elders, this often creates a problem when they are forced to reimburse Social Security for a year, in some cases, 2 or 3 years, because of those dividend amounts. And this is something that a lot of our elders can't afford, yet, you know, because of the dividend check they got, they've got to reimburse these people because they've considered income.
Getting dividends may make an older person ineligible for
Social Security for certain periods of time or for a certain amount of money, you know. So overall, ANCSA has done little to improve either the economic or social status of Alaska Natives, especially in the bush. You know. The majority of Alaska Natives had visions of receiving a fair amount for their lands that have been taken from them since the Western culture began its greedy migration into the Arctic. In the beginning, our ancestors welcomed these people. When the dangers of their influx into Alaska were finally realized, the gold miners and fur trappers already outnumbered our people. And this in part resulted from thousands of our people dying from diseases that the Western culture brought with them. Many people had visions of owning parcels of land on which they would be able to continue their subsistence hunting and fishing lifestyle. It seems that the United States government is more concerned that our migratory birds go south and be shot in farmers' fields and by skeet shooters than allowing us to continue our subsistence hunting to survive. It's always been our custom to allow the good hunters to catch more than the current limits and share with people who were berry pickers or green pickers or fishermen, who in turn would share their crop and catch with the hunters. You know, the lands that were to be ours are now controlled by a board of directors with restrictions on the use of that land by about every federal and state agency that exists. On top of that, we've got other organizations, mostly special interest, who worry more about the preservation of a blade of grass or a willow or some obscure hillside that maybe, you know, just maybe, 1 out of 50 million people may want to look at in its original state sometime in the future than about the preservation of our people, our culture, or our heritage. And they don't seem to recall that the Eskimo has lived and survived up here for thousands of years without scarring the land as much as they have in just a little over 100 years. Before they came with their laws and their regulations, there was always a good balance of game to feed our people. It's about time they looked at their own history and worried about the animals that they have eliminated and leave us to hunt and fish for subsistence. It is proven, you know, that the Eskimo has never hunted themselves out of game and probably never will. It may have been a wild dream, but I think it was a dream of many that when our land claims were settled, we would own and rule our land. This does not seem to be the case. They seem to regulate, or they still regulate, our land by the state and federal fish and game, by EPA, by coastal zone management, and by BLM's easements, rights of ways, and countless other ways that seem to crop up as the immigrants need them. Our land is cut into many pieces by outdated, current, and future easements and right-of-ways that have been, are, or may be needed by the immigrant public. I personally feel that it wasn't intended that we own our land very long. You know, for instance, conveyance of those lands by legislation of both houses and signed by the president specifically stated that all land be conveyed or to be conveyed would be conveyed within 5 years. Yet the bureaucracy, Congress's hirelings, have chosen to ignore that law and in 12 years have not completed we have to comply with the letter of the law. You know, this bureaucrats that work for them. You know, it's asked, what are the moral and ethical principles upon which our claims are based? I think first that the following questions need to be answered. When were our people ever conquered by either the United States of America or Russia? What gave Russia the right to sell to the United States anything but the buildings that they built on Eskimo, Aleut, or Tlingit lands? If they did not give the Alaska Natives his aboriginal rights, who gave them the right to extinguish them? When did the United States ever negotiate with any of the major tribes of Alaska to take over our tribal leadership? If we must discuss the moral and ethical principles before those questions are asked, I would have to ask more questions. Did the negotiations on the part of the United States actually see ANCSA as a benefit to the Alaska Natives? Did our leaders and the leaders of the United States sit down to discuss and analyze the outcome of ANCSA? Why has BLM not completed the conveyance of our lands within the time frame allocated by law? Choose to bend or completely ignore that law? Why has BLM allowed so many of these immigrants to come in and establish camps, summer homes, and sometimes businesses on lands that had been frozen by federal government until we were conveyed our land selections? You know, in 1969, from was frozen, yet people have settled on them, they've camped on them, they've done everything on those lands that we couldn't do because they were frozen. Excuse me. I think you can look at the history of the European Western culture since they have landed on the North American continent. In my travels, I have yet to meet an Indian from any Indian tribe who feels that the United States has ever lived up to any of the treaties that they have signed with any of the American Indian tribes. They have always found ways of slowly eroding away anything they have conceded to us as they needed it. I think our people are justly concerned that the immigrants are already in the process of